Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Dave Malloy. We also review Big Fish, The Apple Family Plays, Murder for Two, Domesticated, Lady Day, and The Jacksonian. So please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, November 10th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Michael Portantier and Ken Jones. Kenneth Jones is a New York City theater journalist and dramatist who was a theater critic and reporter for the Detroit News for a decade before becoming a leading writer and editor at Playbill.com for 15 years. His work appeared at Backstage, TDF Stages, and many other places. He now blogs on his own site, bykennethjones.com, when he's not working on his own plays and musicals. Good morning, Ken.
Hey, James.
Welcome back. Peter is yet again traveling this week, but hopefully we will have him back next week. But thank you again for stepping in as Peter Felicia.
I'm happy to be his swing.
Alrighty. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many other places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
With us this morning, we have Dave Malloy. Dave is the winner of an Obie Award, a Richard Rogers Award, a Jonathan Larson Grant. He is the writer of Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812. I stumbled over that so many times I thought I was going to get it wrong. Good morning, Dave. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you so much.
So, Dave, I have to start off with I'm incredibly angry with you.
I'm so sorry.
because I'm going through DaveMalloy.com and I found the 99-cent Miss Saigon there. And I can't believe that I didn't get a chance to see this. You did this in Berkeley, California in March of 2006, was that?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
That was kind of the piece that
reintroduced me to the musical theater form. I had kind of been staying away from it for a while, and then I just submerged myself completely in it with that show.
I have to encourage everybody to go over to DaveMalloy.com and there's a YouTube video where you do Last Night of the World on it. And it is just to tell us what inspired you to do a 99-cent version of Miss Saigon.
It was really the inspiration of the director, whose name is Maya Grant. And she had this impulse to do the biggest budget, most spectacular spectacle filled Broadway musical of all time as low budget as possible. She wanted to do a 99-cent version. And, you know, we did it in this, it was in a middle school metal shop.
Uh-huh.
This metal shop that had been, like, all the machines had been cleared out. So it was just this empty room. You know, all the costumes were like thrift stores or like our own clothes. We used a balloon for the little kid because we couldn't afford, you know, to pay a child actor. We had, and then the big moment was we had a G.I. Joe helicopter moved from the balcony down to the stage on a zip line. So that was our helicopter moment. Yeah.
And you
and it was wonderful. Like we found that, I mean, yeah, and like the thing about it was that we really tried to really honor the material and do it like as unironically as possible. So we're still completely honoring the story. And I mean, the music is so beautiful. And of course, since we had no budget, the orchestra was me on piano, a clarinet, a violin, and a bass drum. That's all we had.
I wanted to point out that you were not only on piano, but you were also Chris.
Yes, I was.
So the logistics get tough there.
Yeah. Well, it was fun. My favorite moment in that show was there's a song called The Telephone Song where Chris is kind of telling John about what just happened to him with Kim over the telephone.
Yeah.
And I was playing piano on that as well. And it starts off with a piano figure that I could play with one hand. So I had the phone in one hand and the piano in the other hand. But then the piano part gets more complicated, so I had to do it with both hands. And it was an imaginary phone. So then I would lean my head to the side as though I was cradling the phone against my shoulder while I was still playing piano.
So yeah, tell me, very fun moment. So tell me, you were out in Berkeley. Were you a West Coast-based person?
I lived out there for 10 years. Yeah, I grew up in Cleveland, and then right after school, I moved out to San Francisco, and that's kind of where I got my start doing theater.
Where did you go to school?
Ohio University.
Oh,
A smaller school in the southeast corner of Ohio.
And so you went out to there. So how did you get from Berkeley back to New York? And tell us a little about how Natasha Pierre got started.
Sure. I ended up in New York because when I started doing theater out in San Francisco, I started doing it mostly with a theater group called Banana Bag and Bodice. And they're a very downtown experimental theater company. And they lived in San Francisco, and then they moved to New York. And I stayed in San Francisco. And so for a while, I was kind of going back and forth between the two cities, doing shows with them and back and forth. And so they eventually got me to move out here permanently. And then Comet was... Actually, while I was living in San Francisco, I was working on cruise ships for a while. And so I was working on a cruise ship. I think it was in Alaska at that time, like the Alaskan cruise. And I had a girlfriend back in San Francisco. And the way that one of the things we decided to do to like stay together during that time was that we decided to read a massive book together. And so, of course, we just both read Anna Karenina and loved it. So we decided to read War and Peace together, you know, like emailing each other and talking on the phone about it. So that was my exposure to War and Peace. And when we got to both of us, when we got to this particular section, the sliver that we adapt for Great Comet, we were both just blown away by how incredibly moving and powerful this particular section of the book is.
You know, I meant to ask you, I may have read about this when the show opened, but if I did, I forgot. It's interesting that you just said that, because much of the score sounds to me like you took text directly from the book, obviously in translation, and mm-hmm. set it to music. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. I mean, I basically to write the libretto, I started with the public domain translation. The very first translation made of it is now in the public domain. So I started with that in a Word document, and basically the act of making the libretto was just editing that, so just whittling that down to the bare essentials. And then obviously there is some original text as well, like especially all the kind of meta theatrical stuff, like the prologue is all written by me and some of the other stuff.
And Sonia sings this amazing song called Sonia Alone, where she mm-hmm. sort of she concludes in a couple of the lines, she says, "Is it all on me? Is it all on me?" Which seems wildly contemporary. It's so beautiful. Is that you, or is that...
That song is actually one of my favorites in terms of, like, that's where I really felt like I was collaborating with Tolstoy. So like that particular line, "It's all on me," that is written by me, mm-hmm. but it's inspired by this one, it's just a paragraph in that section of the book where Sonia realizes that this is going to be up to her, that she's the only one that can save Natasha at this point. So some of the words in that song are Tolstoy, some of the words are me. And so it's a really nice mixture of the two.
It's a great melding of contemporary and pop and folk, and Britton Ashford is so brilliant doing it.
Oh, she's amazing. Yeah. She's an old friend of mine. The song was actually written for her, for her voice.
What in preparing for it, what kind of musical research did you feel a responsibility to do in terms of Russian folk songs, and how much was it just burbling up from your own language?
There was definitely a fair amount of both. I mean, I definitely did some research into, I was listening to a lot of like Borodin and Tchaikovsky and kind of the Russian classical greats. But then I also had a bunch of like Russian rock music from the 70s and contemporary Russian techno music and Russian folk music. So I was literally listening to all that stuff quite a bit. But at the same time, I mean, my own preferences in music are very, very much in the show as well. So there's a lot of indie rock influences and some, like, there's a lot of vocal jazz harmonies in the show and some jazz, a lot of different influences in the score for sure. Yeah.
The orchestration is one of the most interesting things about the show. I mean, how did you choose what instruments you were going to have?
Definitely I knew I wanted a string section for the pathos of it all, you know, kind of the operatic nature of the show. And I tend to just favor low instruments over high instruments, so that's why the strings are two cellos and viola, as opposed to like a more traditional string quartet with violins. And then clarinet, I knew I wanted for the kind of the klezmery aspect of some of the Russian folk sounds. And then oboe was kind of the last classical sound. I knew I definitely wanted that very traditional, beautiful classical orchestral sound for that. And then in addition to that, there's just a traditional rhythm section to drive the more driving rock numbers. And then there's a really strong laptop component as well. So there's quite a bit of electronic music that courses through the score. And that was kind of to both contemporize the music, and also it dramaturgically works because it the electronic music enters with the entrance of Anatole, who's the rogue who seduces Natasha. So he kind of electrifies the room.
So tell us about you have this idea and you start developing it. Did you go to Ars Nova with it, or did Ars Nova come to you, or how did the genesis of this happen?
Well, actually, I mean, I give Ars Nova incredible praise for what they did in getting this thing made. I had the idea, like, just in the back of my head for 4 or 5 years. Like, after I read the book, I was like, oh, that'll be a perfect musical. I should write that someday. But, you know, kind of knowing I never really would, because it was such a ridiculously ambitious and honest project.
Then
Ars Nova approached me. They had seen another show of mine called Beowulf, A Thousand Years of Baggage, which was a rock opera adaptation of Beowulf. And they really liked that, and then I did a concert with them, and I kind of culminated in them making me their composer in residence for 2011, and part of that was a commission. So they said, you can write whatever you want. And so I had this Warren Beef idea in the back of my head, and I very sheepishly kind of proposed, well, I kind of always wanted to do this opera based on Warren Beef, and like just thoroughly expecting them to be like, well, why don't we, maybe in 10 years we'll do that, why don't we start with something a little smaller and more manageable. But to my great surprise and horror, they were like, absolutely, let's do that. That sounds amazing. And so before I knew it, I was like, oh God, I guess I'm doing this now. So they were incredible. They just like they just said yes, you know, and that's just such an important thing for an artist to hear, for someone to just like take a leap of faith like that and say yes to you. It was very, very good.
And was Rachel Chavkin attached from the beginning, from Ars Nova on? What was your relationship with Rachel before this?
Yeah. She was pretty much the only director I could ever imagine doing this piece. She and I had worked on a piece the year before called Three Pianos, which was a piece about Schubert's Winterreise. It was me and two other actors kind of working our way through this song cycle by Schubert. And Rachel just did incredible work on that, and she's just such a joy to work with. And we have a lot of very similar, similar aesthetics. So, yeah, she was attached from the very beginning.
So what was it like when they came to you and they said, we're going to move up to 45th Street?
It was very exciting. Before 45th Street, we were in the Meatpacking District for a little while. Yeah, so we were from Ars Nova to the Meatpacking District to 45th Street. So Ars Nova to Meatpacking, that was kind of the big jump, because that was like, it was the first time I'd ever had a show with a commercial producer and an off-Broadway debut and everything. So that was very unexpected and very exciting and thrilling.
And then they say, we're going up to 45th Street, but we're sort of putting you in a parking lot, you know?
Kind
of.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, because it's like the physical location of a theater has moved, but the theater itself is identical. So, I mean, they literally just moved the tent from Meatpacking District to 45th Street. So when you walk into the space, or the backstage has been changed quite a bit, but the actual performance place is identical to what it was. Mm. So it's actually, and like that was one of the geniuses of the set design, was that it is this radical transformation. So actually walking in through a parking lot is great, because you're in this like, it looks like a tent, it looks like all dilapidated, and then you walk in and it's this opulent, beautiful Russian ballroom. So it's a transformative entrance.
It's the magic of theater.
Yeah.
So coming along with that is now a new release on Shikaboom Records of your cast recording. So in between all of this and you have other projects in the work that we're going to get to in a second, but now you have to record an album. What was that like?
Oh, that was such a thrill. Like for me, that was like actually the pinnacle of the whole thing. Like that's been the most exciting thing for me, just because as someone who grew up listening to Cast albums, and like, you know, I still remember my mom's like copy of a chorus line, and like the, one of our first CDs was Les Mis, and just kind of listening to that stuff as a kid. So, but to have the thing, you know, preserved like that is quite a treat. And the recording session itself was so much fun. Just having everyone in the room together, blasting through these songs, and the guy who mixed it, Dean Chernow, was incredible. And so I worked really closely with him, making it sound, you know, exactly the way we wanted it to sound. And so yeah, it's been great. And I've been listening to it ever since it came out, and I'm very, very over the moon with how well it came out.
And it's a 2-CD set with 48-page booklet. You know, that doesn't happen to a lot of people. That's quite an investment.
I know. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm so glad that the decision was made to do the full score, because it is an opera. So I feel like you really need to have, you know, the whole thing to make sense of it. Yeah. And the booklet is beautiful. The person who designed that was quite brilliant as well. Yeah.
I was listening to it yesterday, and there's so many places that I love, but I love the scene at the opera where Natasha and Anatole first meet, and their subsequent seduction scene. It is so hot. It's really great. I love that scene.
Thank you.
So all while this is happening, I see that you have other projects in the work. You have an Indiegogo happening right now for Blue Wizard, Black Wizard. So tell us a little. Tell us a little bit about this. Let's see if we can get you up over your goal.
Sure. The show is called Black Wizard, Blue Wizard, or Blue Wizard, Black Wizard, depending on who you talk to. And this is the writer and I are collaborating on this, and we're playing dueling wizards. So I play the Black Wizard, and she plays the Blue Wizard. And it's very much a show about wizards kind of existing in a mundane world. So it's got like elements of the fantastic, but also elements of the everyday. It's kind of, I think, you know, one of the initial impulses was like, how do wizards clean their clothes? Like, do they go to the dry cleaner? Do they go to the laundromat? So just kind of thinking about those kind of things. Yeah, it's a very fun show. There's epic wizard battles. There's a lot of techno music in it. There's a 12-person dancing ensemble. And yeah, it's a very, very fun show. We actually just did our designer run last night and kind of saw the whole thing all together for the first time. And it was quite a bit of fun.
So that's down at Incubator Arts Project, which is at St. Mark's Church in the Bowery. That's down on East 10th Street, and December 5th through the 22nd. So you will have two shows running in New York at the same time.
Yes, I know. It's very exciting. And in very different locations. I mean, I actually really love kind of straddling that line between the uptown world and the downtown world, and kind of having my foot in both places is very exciting for me.
So, you won Obies, you have a Richard Rodgers Award and a Jonathan Larson Grant. It seems as though that you must have a lot of projects in the works. How is that all going? Anything you want to talk about to tell us about?
Sure, yeah, I have a couple of new projects in development. One is a piece about Rachmaninoff, which is kind of the, I've always imagined that I had like a Russian trilogy. So actually before Great Comet, I had a piece about Rasputin called Beardo. And that happened out in Berkeley at the Shotgun Players. And so then Comet is the middle piece. And then this third piece is the piece about Rachmaninoff and hypnotism. Because Rachmaninoff actually wrote his second piano concerto under hypnosis. So that's a pretty interesting story to me. So that show is definitely going to use Rachmaninoff's music and like remix it and deconstruct it, and I'll be writing songs based on his harmonies and things like that. So I'm very excited about that.
Didn't you also have a Russian ballet? Did I read that somewhere?
Well, the Rasputin show ended with a Russian ballet.
Oh, okay.
So the scene in which you have these three murderers murder Rasputin, and you know, Rasputin had a really hilarious death, and they attempted to kill him. Like, first they tried to poison him, but that didn't do it, and then they shot him, and that didn't do it, and so then finally they wrapped him in a rug and drowned him. So we turned that segment of that show into a Russian ballet, so the murderers were wearing tutus and everything.
So you have your Russian trilogy, and anything else in the works after that?
I have a piece I'm working on out in San Francisco about Taoism. So that's kind of another thing on my docket. And then Rachel and I have been talking about both Moby Dick and the Henry Ad. So we're still kind of, they're both big long-term projects, but I think we're going to tackle those one of these days.
All right. And are you a New Yorker now, Dave?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, great. I want to remind everybody that you can check out Dave Malloy at davemalloy.com. The Great Comet of 1812.com is where you can find Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812. And the right now, performances are scheduled through Tuesday, December 31st. The record can be found at chickaboom.com or Amazon and iTunes and all these other places you get that stuff. Dave, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
All right. We'll speak to you soon. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Great of Dave Malloy to join us on a Sunday morning. It's, you know, I think that he's an up-and-comer, and hopefully good things will happen with his shows. Michael, do you think Natasha Pierre would transfer to an official Broadway house, or do you think that it'll be considered for a Tony, or...
No, it won't be considered for a Tony. I determined that some time ago. I think I may have mentioned it.
Yeah, that's right. You know, you mentioned it.
Yeah, and I almost wanted to ask Dave about that, but I wasn't sure. You know, I didn't want to put him on the spot. As I said, I had heard through a very good source that there was serious discussion of moving the show into the into the St. James. And they were going to apparently completely redo the theater, and it really didn't make any economic sense to me whatsoever. You know, why they would spend that much money to redo that theater, which is considered one of the prime Broadway houses as it is. But at any rate, that didn't happen, and I have such mixed feelings about it because I love the show. I do think it's very award-worthy and very Tony Award-worthy. I'm just not sure how commercial it would be on Broadway, you know, like anything else. I mean, it's the very fact that it's so fresh and so new and so original is what's great about it. But there's unfortunately, more and more, there seems to be a resistance to that on Broadway. People want what they know. So, So I don't. This run will not be eligible. Will not be Tony eligible.
Well, can the tent stay? Can this extend?
Well, I don't think so because they do have a pretty firm closing date. I don't know if it has to do with partly with the heat situation, but I guess not because I mean it must be pretty cold already, and they must have some. You know, they probably have those big heater things in there. I don't think so. I'm not sure.
Well, you know, January and February are very cold in both temperature and in sales. So they might be prudent to close it for January, February, maybe remount it in March.
Who knows? And I did hear again that they are again looking at Circle in the Square, which is again empty. That would be ideal in terms of the setup as is already much closer to what they have and what they need. That would be great if they could work out some kind of financial arrangement. Parenthetically, I don't know how the show, I don't know how its numbers are working now. I'm not quite sure how they can be breaking even or let alone making any money. Considering the construction costs and everything else, so I imagine that, you know, I do love the show, and I think it, you know, if it runs over time, obviously it has a much better chance of breaking even or making a profit. So I hope they figure out a place where they can do that, and I hope it's Broadway so they can be Tony eligible.
All right, so let's move on. The three of us have finally seen Big Fish.
Yes.
I was originally scheduled, as well as I think Michael was originally scheduled to see it, but then Norbert got sick and we had to reschedule to see Norbert Leo Butz in it. So let's start off with Big Fish. Michael, why don't you tell us about what your experience was?
Well, the really, really good news for me is that I very much like the score, music and lyrics by Andrew Lipa. And the reason I say that that's such good news for me is that I intensely disliked his work on Adam's Family. I thought there was not a moment of inspiration hardly in that entire score. And I don't think I'm alone in that opinion. I seem to remember that the score received tremendously bad reviews and was considered responsible for the fact that that show ultimately didn't have a very long run. I also didn't like Andrew's work of the songs that he added to A Good Man Charlie Brown. And I didn't even like most of his version of The Wild Party, because although I thought a lot of the individual songs were very, very good, successful on their own, it seemed to me that there was no overall style whatsoever. And it was very scattershot in those terms. And that always bothers me when a score doesn't seem cohesive. So I'm very happy to say that I liked the score to Big Fish, music and lyrics. I think he did an excellent job. It does seem cohesive, and it just seemed to fit the very fanciful tone of the show. I'm looking forward to the cast album very much. And the show itself, which received, I would say, largely negative reviews, it's fair to say. Again, I overall really liked it. I think it has problems, but I liked it much, much more than I expected to. The sad thing is, to me, that I think that things that bring it down might have been quite easily fixable, but they're not. And I think it comes down to two things. I think too much time is spent on the tall tale sequences. For those who don't know, this is basically the story of a man and his son. The father has a propensity for telling very, very tall tales about his youth. And the son, I guess maybe when he's a child, he really loves them. But then as he grows up, he starts to rebel against them and think, you know, starts to consider them annoying and counterproductive and really not a very good thing. So we see all of these tall tales enacted on the stage in sometimes very, very elaborate musical numbers. And I don't necessarily think the elaborateness is the problem. Susan Stroman is the director and choreographer, and there's some really quite amazing choreography, as you might imagine. But it just, to me, that if there were a little less of those tall tales, if each one of them went on just a little bit less. It seems to me that each one of them just kind of goes on a little too long and wears out its welcome. And I found myself, at many points wanting to get back to the actual scenes in the real world, you know, the scenes that involve the man and his son and the son's fiance and eventually wife and the grandson and the other characters in the real world. So I thought that was a storytelling problem that, again, I guess is fairly fixable, because you know how it is in shows. Sometimes a minute on stage can make all the difference. You know, 1 minute less can make something seem much more effective than, you know, rather than just something that you kind of like, all right, I've got the point, let's move on. So I wish they had looked at that a little more. And the other thing, I hate to even say this, the sound amplification almost destroyed the show for me. It was so unnatural. I absolutely hated it. That's happening more and more lately, and I'm sick of it. I just can't stand it. I almost tried to find the sound person and say, are these the levels that you think have been instructed to set for this show? I mean, it's really appalling. And I think and I do think I made this point before, I think sometimes that shows that are considered not to be working, I think they even crank them up further as if that's a solution to the problem. But it's absolutely the wrong solution to the problem. The whole point of this show is to bring you into this relationship between the father and the son, and to bring you into the characters and this wonderful story about their, you know, their relationship and their very, very ambivalent relationship with each other and how it eventually ends up, which is very, very moving at the end of the show. So it's a show, it's a show that should bring you into it. It's not something that you want thrown at you, you know, at 55,000 decibels. It's, I was incensed by the sound design. And I think that really they should be, that was a tremendous mistake to run it at that volume.
So to have the orchestra in back, I wonder if that was one of the reasons why they did that. But I did notice what you were saying. Michael and I actually were sitting a few rows apart.
Oh, that's right.
That night, and I did notice that the sound was very, very loud, and we were 10 rows from the stage. And, all the actors were coming loud and clear through the PA system and not, I hate that if you're so close and you really can hear their natural voice. Why do they need to be amplified,
Yeah.
So, Ken, what did you think about Big Fish?
Well, one of the great takeaways of the show, I think, is that it's actually about men, which musicals rarely are fully about a relationship between two men. This is a father and son story, trying to figure out your past with your father is a very ambitious thing for a musical. And there is a sentimental quality to the climax of the show. There are multiple sentimental scenes. I guess it's not giving anything away to learn that Edward Bloom is a sick man and he's struggling with illness. That's Norbert's character. And at the end of the show, people are sobbing around me and there's a kind of recognition that's there were men crying around me. It was really moving. And, I can't help repeating the word ambition in a way. I'm kind of baffled at the not good reviews for Andrew Lippa. I thought they were very mean, some of them, and I think it's a really solid score from him. The book is by John August, who did the screenplay, and there's a knockout performance by Kate Baldwin. Full disclosure, Kate's a pal of mine, but I thought she showed such incredible variety. You know, she's got to play 17, she's got to play 60. And she's got one of the great theater voices.
Best performance I've ever seen her give. She was terrific. And Norbert Leo Butz, we should say, since we didn't actually mention his full name, is Edward Bloom.
And Bobby Steger plays his son. So, yeah.
Did you think, Ken, do you think that the bad reviews of the score are residual hatred from the Addams Family? I mean, I'm with you. I don't know why what people heard in it that they dislike so much. I don't get it.
I don't know. Maybe, sincerity is a big part of this show. It is a very sincere show. Mm. And there may be in part of the critical community a distaste for sincerity. There is a place for this show. It's a it's not a critical hit. It's an audience hit. It's an audience show. Who knows what the thinking is. I do hope there's an album. I don't think there's an album announced yet. Albums cost $250,000. So, that has yet to be seen.
What was I going to say? Yeah. Did you have a similar reaction to the sound level, Ken?
I don't have that memory. No, I see it. I saw it just before opening. I didn't have that response. No.
Sure did.
First of all, I'm a big fan of Lippa, and I actually am a big fan of his Wild Part. But I also really liked the music in Big Fish, and I thought that a lot of the criticism of the of the score in Big Fish was not really fair. But I had a similar reaction to you, Michael Portantier, about the
sequences.
And I think that the tall tales are really, really critical and important. I don't think they can cut them. What I did feel is that Susan Stroman turned everything into a big number, and mm-hmm. I thought that was detrimental to the show, and that I felt that the show was a little bit too long, and I felt like the show was it was meandering because it was like this was a huge opportunity to have a big number here, and it didn't need to. I felt it took away from telling the story. And Michael, did you see the movie? Are you a fan of the movie?
No, I went in cold, so my reaction is based completely on this. I certainly don't think that the tall tales should be cut out a lot, just a little bit. But your point is also well taken. If not every one of them had been a huge production number, then they might have seemed more welcome and more organic and not seem too long.
Yeah. And, I think that something that I didn't hear either one of you mention that was a huge wow for me was the incredible set design and the costume design and the things that they did up there to change the space was really very well thought out, ingenious, clever, amazing to look at, visually stimulating. I just felt as though that the story wasn't told as well as it could have been told. Mm-hmm. And I blame the director. I blame Susan Stroman for that.
Costume design by William Ivy Long, who, it goes without saying, just hundreds of amazing credits. Scenic design by Julian Crouch, who I think maybe is not one of the most active set designers, so that's interesting. But yes, really, really great job.
I think that the things that I disagreed with most were signature Susan Stroman moments of painting the big picture on the stage and having the big number, and I just at some point or another, and maybe it's because I'm not a dancer, you just don't need so much dance. Oh my god, I was just like, really, another number?
Yeah, just like I say, just a little too much, Yeah. I mean, because, yes, if you and also because there's so much of it, James, each one becomes less effective.
Dilution. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a law of diminishing returns, and it's just not to take away from the talent of the people on the stage, which was amazing, or even the talent of Susan Stroman, because each one of those things in a vacuum were amazing, but it was just part of a night that, I felt delayed the telling of the story,
right?
In order to show some wonderful choreography and wonderful dance talent up on the stage, and that makes me nuts in any type of show when we delay the story in order to show off.
Yes, and I think that although we may disagree on what the general critical opinion of the score was, I think we agree on that point. I think that many of the reviews mentioned that and felt that that was a major issue here.
As I said, I was a big fan of the Wild Party, and I'm a big fan of the Wild Party, and I noticed a lot of seemingly parallelisms between the structure of the score in Big Fish and Wild Party, or maybe I made that up, but I'd love to hear from listeners out there who are fans of the Wild Party that also saw Big Fish, and see if you agreed or disagreed with me on that point. So, if you do, please let us know. Go to the show page, and there's all the contact information for all three of us, and you can, let us know what you thought as well. So, should I move on? Do you guys have anything less left to say about Big Fish?
I have a plot question, but I think maybe I should save it till we're not recording anymore, because I don't want it to be a spoiler.
Okay, and also we'll have to when Peter returns, we'll get Peter's take on Big Fish as well. So moving on, Ken, you went down to the Public and saw Richard Nelson's plays. You saw three out of the four of the Apple Family plays.
Yeah, this is the cycle of four plays that he's written about current events, sort of New York-centered current events. Each play set on a milestone date. So yeah, for the past 3 weeks, I've gone and seen one each, and the fourth play in the cycle is called Regular Singing. It has its world premiere on the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. Each play takes place on a sort of fraught day. The first play, That Hopi Changey Thing, is election night 2010. The play Sweet and Sad is the 10th anniversary of 9/11. The play Sorry is on the election day of Obama's second term, where nobody's sure if it's Romney or Obama. And I'm a huge fan of Richard Nelson. I like the smallness of what he does. I like that he's not always writing a well-made play. There are conversations happening. There's certainly structure to his work. He wrote Nikolai and the Others for Lincoln Center Theater a year ago, last season. And it's very much echoes Nikolai and the Others in that it's people at a dinner table talking about their lives and trying to figure out their place in the world. They're always talking about local politics or national politics, and it always reflects their own personal lives. The personal and the political meld really beautifully in these plays. These are tiny, tiny plays, 90 minutes each. They're staged in the Ansbacher Theater, that great three-quarter thrust at the Public. And I can't wait to see what happens in the fourth play. I just want to mention the cast, if I can. J.O. Sanders, Marianne Plunkett, Lila Robbins, Sally Murphy, John DeVries, and Stephen Kunkin. It's about three sisters and a brother, and they're all in Rhinebeck, New York, gathering for these family reunions. I was going to say there's an affordable way to get to this, and I'm sure the Public won't want me to mention it, but I've actually gotten my tickets on TDF, $21, and it's a fantastically affordable experience while tickets last. I'm sure that won't last. There are marathon sessions that will happen where you can see everything in a weekend. And it's called The Apple Family, subtitled Scenes from Life in the Country, which echoes his Russian interest, his Chekhovian interest as well. Yeah, I loved it.
All right, great. So next up on the agenda, we have Murder for Two. Michael and Ken got a chance to see that. So Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
I really loved it. It's a two-character. No, that's not correct. It's a two-act. It's a two-actor show. Even that's not correct. It's a two-performer show because the two performers are Jeff Blumenkrantz and Brett Ryback. And in addition to acting, they both play the piano quite often during the show. They are the only. They are their own orchestra. And it's a comic murder mystery with Brett Ryback playing Marcus, this fellow who's investigating the murder, and Jeff Blumenkrantz playing all of the suspects. I would say, I'm guessing, maybe about a dozen. It's interesting. I haven't seen yet A Gentleman's Guide to Murder. Either of you, by any chance?
No, I'm seeing it today.
I'm going to see it this week, I think, or next week.
Yeah, I think from what I've read, because I haven't seen that either, that they are somewhat similar in that in that show is not our understanding that Jefferson Mays plays all of the
victims.
He plays all of the victims. Okay, so that's the difference. Yeah. In this case, Jeff Blumenkrantz is playing all of the suspects, but so that's funny that they're opening at the same time. I guess that'll be interesting to see one in the context of the other.
But Jeff Blumenkrantz, one difference from what I've read is that Jeff Blumenkrantz does not change costume as he does these lightning fast shifts from one suspect to the other, all the time, you know, running over to play the piano. And it's really delightful. I loved it. But this is one of those shows. Isn't it interesting? Ken was just talking about Richard Nelson, whom I have absolutely no affinity for whatsoever. I have disliked every play he's ever written, and it's gotten to the point where I feel like I don't want to see one ever again. Obviously, I'm not in. Well, I mean, obviously, there are many people who disagree with that, including Ken. But that relates to Murder for Two, because I went with a friend of mine. I'm sitting there laughing and smiling and you know, and applauding, and he's sitting there with a stone face. And then next to us was Ken Fallon, the really notable theater caricaturist, with his companion. I don't know who he was with, but Ken was loving it, and at one point his friend is sitting there stone faced, and he turned to his friend and said, "Why aren't you laughing?" And he said, "Because I don't think it's funny." So there you are, four people, you know, with two divergent opinions. Really interesting how that happens, and you know, but that's what keeps theater interesting, isn't it? I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was delightful. Directed by Scott Schwartz, now at New World Stages, and yeah, I would urge everyone to go see it. Saying at the same time that obviously it's not for everyone, but then again, what is?
I like to engage in hyperbole, and I've been saying in recent weeks that I think it really is one of the best musical comedy scores of the past decade, you know, the past 20 years. It's kind of pitch perfect in terms of craft and shape and sophistication and cleverness, and there's not a bad rhyme in it. You know, it's an old school kind of off-Broadway score. You know, we would identify it as off-Broadway. It's piano and voice, and it's specialty numbers and charm songs, and again, some incredibly sincere moments too in an unexpected love interest that pops up.
Yes.
And let's mention the songwriters as well. It's Joe Kanosian and Kellen Blair wrote the score. And I think they share book credit, or one of them wrote the book. But those guys are terrific. They won a Jeff Award in Chicago. This was a long-running hit at Chicago Shakespeare Theater. And it has been slightly tweaked since coming here. I gathered they have added a new number. I saw it this summer at Second Stage Uptown, and now it's moved to New World Stages. I think there's an opening number, and they've tweaked some stuff as well.
Yes.
So I'm looking forward to going back down and seeing it. I laughed a lot. I thought it was incredibly clever. It doesn't out it, for me, it doesn't outstay its welcome. It's not a 2.5-hour show. It's a very, very brisk experience. And to see Jeff Blumenkrantz on his knees with a baseball cap playing three children.
In a boys' choir, right?
In a boys' choir. That's maybe the best 5 minutes of musical comedy I've seen all year. It's something to see. Jeff Blumenkrantz is a force of nature, and Brett is terrific too.
Yeah, Jeff is well known to many of our listeners, I'm sure, as both an actor and a writer himself. But Brett, looking at his credits, I guess is new to the city. He's done a lot of regional work, some major things regionally. But let's see, and yeah, and he's also a writer and obviously a piano player, musician. He was a great find and very, very charming. And their chemistry was great. The night I went, it seemed like there was one point where Jeff was doing something that almost made Brett lose it. I like that in a show like this. Obviously, I mean, you wouldn't want that in Long Day's Journey into Night, but in a light musical comedy, I think that can add to it if it seems like it's spontaneous and it's not overdone. The audience loved it, and yeah. I highly recommend. I hope there's a place for a show like this in
off-Broadway, you know, we hear about the death of the off-Broadway musical, but the fact that it's two characters, you know, two performers, again, two performers, might help it financially.
Yeah, I mean, back in the day when Forbidden Broadway was happening, this is the kind of show that would run for a decade off-Broadway, but economics are different today. I think it will have a huge life in regional theater and resident theater, and I gather a cast album is in the works as well, so people will get to know it more deeply in the cast album. And it is very much like a puzzle, isn't it, Michael? The sort of intertwining of music and lyrics and mystery, and then trying to figure out how they cast it, and then trying to figure out who's going to play piano for a certain section. It's very much a puzzle. I think the mystery is incidental.
Yeah. Yes, I would like to see it again, just because there's so much going on. And absolutely, there will be times when someone will like be sort of like, you know, delivering a song, and then he'll kind of like reach back and play a few notes on the piano. You know, it's ingeniously well done, but you have to have two incredibly talented people, needless to say.
And do they still do the two-hand specialty interlude together?
Yes.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, it's just this unexpected piano sequence that ingenious. I loved it.
All right, so let's move on to our next thing, which is Domesticated at Lincoln Center. Michael got a chance to see that. So, Michael, what did you think?
Again, this is a case where Domesticated is a play by Bruce Norris, who wrote Clybourne Park, a play that apparently was in the tremendous minority and really disliking. I thought it was about an inch deep, very facile. I don't care how many Pulitzer Prizes or Tony Awards it won. I just really, really don't like it and thought it was not worthwhile at all. So I was very happy that Domesticated, I thoroughly enjoyed. It's very smart and extremely well written, and I think it has a lot to say about how a man in a position of power, in this case a politician, can be completely have his life destroyed through his own inability to control his sexual urges. And it's kind of like the amazing thing about this play is it's quite hilarious through much of the length of the script, but at the same time you're quite horrified as to how he's like completely falling. His life is just completely falling apart, and it doesn't really stop. I mean, it just keeps spiraling downwards. And when you think maybe he's finally gotten to a point where, you know, a plateau, no, he something happens and he goes even lower. And it's really amazing. Structurally, it's an interesting play. In the first act, it opens with the fellow Bill giving a, you know, a press conference with his wife, played by Laurie Metcalf, her character name is Judy, standing, you know, staunchly by his side with, you know, with a very, you know, grim face, while he apologizes for his indiscretion, you know, or whatever word you want to use for it. And he can't even get through the apology. He keeps interrupting himself and second guessing himself and commenting on his own apology. And so then that scene is over, and then the story proceeds. And what's interesting is that Goldblum doesn't really talk again until the end of the first act. He's just kind of, you know, he's always on stage, or almost on stage, but things are happening around him, and he, you know, all this horrible stuff is happening, and you kind of, he's just standing there like, as almost like this completely inactive, you know, member of his own destruction. But then he makes up for it in act two. He does a lot of talking, the character, and it's just really, really very well done, directed by Anna Shapiro in The Round, I should say, which is interesting, in the Mitzi Newhouse Theater, which is perfect for it. The other actors are Misha Seg, Emily Mead, Vanessa Aspilaga, Mia Baron, Lisbeth McKay, Karen Pittman, Mary Beth Peel, who was really wonderful in multiple roles. Almost all of the other people play multiple roles. Alec Reed and Robin DeJesus, who, unless I
unless I missed it, he only has one scene, but it's really quite an amazing scene. So I highly recommend Domesticated. For those few of you who, like me, really did not like Clybourne Park, don't let that keep you away, because I think this was it's a very different type of play, first of all. And I highly recommend it.
Yeah, he's such a – I just wanted to chime in that Bruce Norris is such a smart dramatist in that he takes that classic scene of a – as you said, of a politician at a podium at a microphone and his grim wife sitting next to him. It's a scene we've seen repeated so many times in our, you know, national landscape, and that's a launching point for this play. And it's it, you instantly know where you are and what questions are being asked, and I happen to have been one of the people who loved Clybourne Park. This is a play that wants to do for questions of marriage and monogamy and gender what Clybourne Park wanted to do for race, and it's quite dark. It's a sort of a dark ride, isn't it? I mean, the politician, his indiscretions keep mounting. It gets more almost absurd as it goes on, and he's constantly trying to justify his actions. And as you said, Act One sort of belongs to Laurie Metcalf, and Act Two belongs to Jeff Goldblum, and it all dissolves rather brilliantly. And it's a very cynical take on marriage. In a way, it's an heir to Shaw and Coward and Wilde and other people who were disdainful of marriage. And it's very interesting to be happening at a time when we're discussing definitions and boundaries of marriage today. It's a play that's I think quite brilliant.
All right, so. Let's move forward to Lady D at the Little Schubert. Ken, you got a chance to see that? Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, I saw it a couple of weeks ago. I'm a big fan of Dee Dee Bridgewater, the jazz singer and actress. She's a Tony winner. I didn't know. I was reminded that she won the Tony for playing Glinda in The Wiz. I had forgotten that. She's got some wonderful CDs out and won Grammys for her tribute albums to Eleanora Fagan, who is, of course, Billie Holiday, and Ella Fitzgerald. She's got a couple of great CDs out that I love. So here she plays Billie Holiday in a play by a writer that I don't know, named Stephen Stahl. This play was done in the 80s in London and Paris. Dee Dee Bridgewater did it in French in the 80s, and then it moved to London, where she did it in England. She did it in England. It ran at the Donmar, and then it ran at the Piccadilly. And now it's been revived and resuscitated and rewritten, I gather. It's a portrait of tragic blues and jazz singer Billie Holiday, and it's got 20 of her great numbers sung by Dee Dee Bridgewater. It is pulled down a little bit by the weight of the script. But as a chance to hear this music again, done by sort of a peerless jazz singer, it does not disappoint on that sense, on that level. I got the sense that every time a number came, the audience relaxed into this experience. Dee Dee Bridgewater does something of a Billie Holiday impersonation, but it really is much richer than that. And Dee Dee has a much different range and brings her high notes and much more of her musical variety to it. So it's not just a mimicry show. And even in some of the more disturbing book scenes, she regresses back to being a child and where she's the victim of a sexual assault. It's, you know, Dee Dee Bridgewater is a fantastic actress. We are reminded in this piece. Act One is on stage in the 50s in a rehearsal experience, and act one is backstage and she's rehearsing, and act two is when she's on the stage and she has a major meltdown on stage. But it's much more physically realized. It's a full production in act two. If you like jazz and Dee Dee Bridgewater and Billie Holiday, it's something to look into.
You know, this is not the first play about Billie Holiday, but I've never seen any of them. There was one called Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill.
Right.
That played, I think, quite a while, some years ago. So, I mean, she's certainly a subject who's ripe for dramatic treatment. What was it like, Ken, to be back in the Little Schubert, the theater that no one can figure out?
Well, I wish they would add one more seat and just make it a Broadway house. Because it's $4.99, which is the Broadway limit, right? Some people think that that's an unforgiving theater. I kind of love it, because even if you're in the back row, it's pitched so high that you can certainly see everything. I wish they would do more stuff there. I don't know what exactly the story is there, that it's been so dormant. I know it's been used as a tech house for a lot of shows, and I gather there have been industrials and things there. But I love the Little Schubert on far away West 42nd Street. Yeah.
Well, I wasn't aware that that a lot of people considered it unforgiving. I think it's fine. Like you say, the sidelines are great. I mean, it's not an old ornate style theater, but I don't think it's ugly.
I think it's large. You know, when people expect an off-Broadway experience, they're expecting a smaller, more intimate experience, and it is a larger house for what we define as off-Broadway.
I think that the Little Schubert has a reputation of being a little bit too expensive for people to make a commercial go of it. Mm-hmm. And so you very often have what we have chatted about before as vanity shows in there.
Right.
I don't know if it's working for the landlord that owns Little Schubert or what's happening there, but certainly... if they were to have a breakout hit there, it would be good for everybody involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, the argument has always been that if they did add one seat and had it made into a Broadway house, then the economics would...
I don't think it falls within the scope of a Broadway house.
Why not?
I think it's outside of the... it's outside of the geographic location of a Broadway house.
No, I don't think geography has anything to do with Broadway.
Yeah,
Broadway is specifically defined by Actors Equity.
By seat number, right?
By seat number, and it is bound by certain streets and avenues.
And they added, did they have to add in order to make the Beaumont?
Beaumont is not a Broadway house. It's not a Broadway show.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Oh, you want to bet?
They're Tony-winning shows.
Yeah,
they're Tony-winning shows. They're not Broadway contracts. They're not production contracts.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, because Lincoln Center is a
nonprofit.
Yeah, right.
Are you saying that the Friedman is not a Broadway house and the American Airlines is not a Broadway house?
That's right. They operate under a different contract. They don't operate under production contract.
Right. Well,
I mean, Broadway is defined by Actors Equity. It's not defined by anybody else. It's not defined by the league. It's not defined by the...
Right, but that's interesting, James. But I think a lot of people consider it defined by whether something is Tony eligible.
Well, yes. Okay.
So,
That's a marketing thing, yes.
Yes. Yeah. So would the Tony committee consider that a Broadway house if they added one more seat in? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what we're saying.
Okay.
Interesting. We'll have to maybe research it.
All righty. So let's move on to the last show of our discussion today, which is the Jacksonian, which is over on Theater Row on 42nd Street. Michael got a chance to see it. So, Michael, tell us about it.
Well, I loathed it. I found it incredibly distasteful by Beth Henley, of all people. It's another sort of murder mystery. It's set in Jackson, Mississippi, in a seedy motel in 1964. Amazing cast: Ed Harris, Glenn Headley, Amy Madigan, and Bill Pullman, and a
really remarkable younger actress named Juliet Brett. And I guess this play was well received in on the West Coast, but directed by Robert Falls. I mean, quite an amazing pedigree. But to me, it's like why these people would want to be involved with this script is beyond me. I just found it very, very distasteful and pointless. And one of the things I really hated about it is that it purports to be, and according to the press materials, about racism. And in fact, there has been a murder committed in the town, and people are trying to or assuming that the murder was committed by an African American. And, you know, this talk of lynching him up. The N-word is used many times, mostly by Amy Madigan's character. I found it offensive because aside from everything else, they start out with discussion of this murder, you know, and the racist aspect of it. And, you know, the Klan, you know, is the Klan going to take retribution and blah, blah, blah. And then it seems to me like it wasn't mentioned for about 8 scenes, you know, and then it came up again. And that's the scene where Amy Madigan uses that word multiple times. And I was cringing. And then it's kind of dropped again for a few scenes, and then it's sort of mentioned again at the end. But I don't think the play, the bulk of the play had anything to do with racism. It was just about this sick relationship between all of these characters. There's a horrific scene where Bill, I mean, we don't get to see this, thank God, but Bill Pullman plays this very, very very scary, strange, weird character who's currently working as a bartender in the, I guess, at the lounge at the motel. And he, at one point, lures the young girl, played by Juliet Brett, back behind the bar to touch his penis. So this is the kind of play it is. You know, maybe you'll like it. I hated it. The Times review, for what it's worth, Ben Bradley, he loved it. He thought it was darkly humorous. I just thought it was offensive and distasteful, and I really, really was turned off by it tremendously.
Oh well.
But there again, you know, there you go again. I think maybe live theater, maybe that tends to create more divergent opinions in the people who see it than films, because a film is still. I mean, obviously there are different opinions on films, but there's still, you know, it's a finished product and it's always the same. But theater, it can be affected by other things. And so maybe that's true. I'm going to have to think about if that's true or not, but certainly it's always fascinating to me how people can love and or hate the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it continues to fascinate me, and you know, I'm not a young person, so I still can't get over it sometimes how you can try to, and you know, you can sit down and try to have someone explain to you why they liked a show you hated or vice versa, but it's probably not going to work. I mean, they might make some points that help you understand, but ultimately we still have our own reactions, and it's really, really, really interesting.
Well, we're all some of our experiences, and yeah. Everybody's got the different experiences. So I could totally understand how we will hit, you know, view things much differently.
Well, but I should have said, I think one of the main reasons I said that about maybe theater being, you know, causing more divergent opinions in the film is because of the audience reaction. I think that can make a tremendous difference in how an individual reacts. So.
Well, you know, and you have, to some extent, when studios are screening films, they could very easily send everybody a screener through the mail. They want to get you to the theater, to the movie theater, to see it with an audience and see how everybody. You know, I think that's a valid point. Absolutely. All right. So anything exciting coming up for you guys this week?
I'm seeing Gentleman's Guide this week.
Uh-huh.
Looking forward to that.
Excellent.
I saw, oh, I traveled to, briefly, I traveled to Morristown, New Jersey last night to see Hello, Dolly with Sally Struthers.
Really?
And she was really fantastic, I have to say. I think she's not given her full due as a musical comedian, especially not as a musical comedian, because I think a lot of people don't even know that she sings really very well. And it was quite a good production. They had problems at the theater. It's a tour that's at like 6 months or more, and I think 70 cities, and they couldn't get apparently 70% of their sets into this theater. Isn't that sad? I mean, you would think these things would be, you know, checked out beforehand. But if what I understand is correct, the problem was that the elevator wasn't large enough. Not that the theater wasn't large enough.
Yeah.
So isn't that too bad? But they did a great job anyway. Great costumes and really, really nice size orchestra and very talented company. So if that comes to your way, around your way, which it may be, because as I said, it's 70 cities, check it out, and I think you'll really enjoy it.
It'll be interesting to see if Dolly gets you know, a Broadway production in the next year. It's the 50th anniversary of Dolly, right?
Yes, I was sitting there really. 2014 is the 50th anniversary. There had been and still is, I guess, maybe sort of talk of a Broadway revival, but I don't know, you know, if that's just you know, how firm those plans are. I don't think they're very firm at all. People are very obviously for good reason. Very scared about who they would cast in the lead because the role, you know, is you know, would require somebody really, really special. But Sally Struthers was great. I wish she had been Miss Hannigan and Annie. Mm. Would have made all the difference in the world. Oh, also in New Jersey, I saw a production of Love, Loss, and What I Wore that a friend of mine directed, Vince Balzano, for the Berkeley Light Opera Company. It was a benefit for them. And that's a wonderful piece. Did either of you see it off Broadway?
No. Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah, by Nora and Delia Ephron. And it carried extra weight. I mean, it's a wonderful piece about how many of women at any rate and especially tend to maybe remember what they were wearing at various you know, really big moments in their lives, whether the happy ones or the sad ones. And it the play, I always liked it, but it I guess maybe it carries a little extra weight now because Nora Ephron has died since the play first premiered off Broadway, and so several of the scenes are about death, and that really gave an extra weight to it. So that's another play you should check out if it comes your way. It's just women sitting and basically reading these monologues of these various characters, but it's highly theatrical for all that, and it's really worthwhile.
Great.
All right. So,
I'm sorry. You know, I have to mention the celebration of the life of Shirley Hers, a really great old time press agent who died several months ago. This was at the Friedman Theater, which has the distinction of the lobby of the Friedman Theater is named after Shirley and Bob Ullman, another great old time press agent. And the Friedman Theater is named after Sam Friedman, another great old time press agent. So that theater, which is the Manhattan Theater Club, I guess is the one that really commemorates the work of those invaluable people. And it's nice to have one theater that does that. The speakers were amazing. They included among the names that would be more familiar to our listeners, Charlotte Moore from the Irish Rep, Liz Smith, Tyne Daly, Barry Brown and Angela Lansbury, who apparently was very, very close. Angela and Liz Smith were very close with Shirley. And Angela, I've seen her speak at several memorial services or life celebrations. And she's always, of course, wonderful and very warm and classy. But this was the one time where I actually saw her lose her composure for a moment, just for a moment, and then she got it back. But it was clear how much Shirley meant to her, and what a wonderful, really long, decades long relationship they had. So I was very happy that I got to see that this tribute to a really great lady.
Yeah, I loved Shirley when I worked with her when I was working for Playbill. There was always a sense of mutual trust about our relationship. She would instantly tell me stuff off the record or tell me what the real story was in terms of helping my coverage and helping the way I approached a story, writing about it or not writing about it. And I miss that because that there's there can be a distrust and a cynicism in the press, in the press agent world, and I always felt like there was a great sense of communication and trust with her.
Yeah, that point was made during the celebration. She somehow was able to really do her job without lying, which can be difficult sometimes when you're a press agent, depending on what's happening. So she figured it out. She knew how to do it.
Yep. All right. So I want to give you a preview of next week, but you know what a really, really dangerous combination is?
What?
They're New Orleans, Patti LuPone, and Seth Rudetsky. Those three together, I can't imagine that one of them's not going to get arrested. You know? It's very, very dangerous. So Seth is down with Patti November 16th, next Saturday night in New Orleans to do a concert. And we're trying to have Seth on Sunday morning. So if he is not arrested, we're going to try to get him on Sunday morning, which is next Sunday. So please join us for that. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you'd like to listen to us in another way, you can listen to us on the Stitcher app. That's an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. And you can stream This Week on Broadway directly to your device. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. And contact information for Peter, for Michael, for Ken, for me, all be found on BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. And I'll throw up a YouTube video of Dave Malloy singing Last Night of the World from the 99 Cent Miss Saigon. So please check that out. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Kenneth Jones, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye. Protect your name and your heart because
coming from